less easy to conceptualize in a single framework. Not by chance, Sperber's follow-up volume has a wordy title that conveys, no doubt unconsciously, the difficulty he encountered in finding a unifying theme. Europe, 1850 to 1914, Progress, Participation, and Apprehension, 2008. Hobsbawm went on to write two more volumes, The Age of Capital, 1975, covering the years 1848 to 1875, and The Age of Empire, 1987, taking the story up to the First World War. Anyone who attempts to write a history of 19th century Europe has to confront these three magnificent books, which tower over the literature on the period. And, with his uncanny gift for conceptual innovation, Hobsbawm went on to characterize the whole period covered by his trilogy as the long 19th century, a model followed by many textbooks and primers. For example, William Simpson and Martin Jones's Europe, 1783 to 1914, 2000. The long 19th century is, however, a broken-backed century, divided into two very different halves by the 1848 revolutions. Not surprisingly, like Sperber, many historians covering the period from the French Revolution or the defeat of Napoleon to the First World War have given up the attempt to find any kind of conceptual unity and have chosen anodyne titles such as Europe's Uncertain Path, 2012, to quote R.S. Alexander's recent political narrative. Through most of the 20th century, historians regarded the rise of nation-states and the conflicts between them as the central features of European history in the 19th century. The triumph of nationalism forged new political and cultural entities and inspired revolts against large and, it seemed, outmoded multinational empires, revolts against oppression by other nationalities, or ambitions to achieve dominance over them. This model of the nation-state was exported across the globe in the 20th century, making its emergence in Europe in the 19th seem even more important. Historians once saw this process in positive terms, putting celebratory accounts of the unification of Italy and Germany, the growth of Czech and Polish national consciousness, and other products of the age of nationalism at the center of their narrative. As national and ethnic rivalries spilled over into the vast conflagration of the Second World War, however, the rise of nationalism appeared in a darker light, a view underlined by the Balkan Wars of the 1990s. But since then, we have come increasingly to live in an age of globalization, as the barriers created by the Cold War have crumbled, international institutions, worldwide means of communication, multinational companies, and many other influences have eroded national boundaries and begun to bind us all together as a global human community. Since the turn of the century, this has also altered our vision of the past, which historians have come to see increasingly in a global perspective. The call for the writing of global history is not in itself new. It was issued as long ago as the 1970s by the French historian Marc Ferro, and was present in the concept of Universalgeschichte, universal history, as practiced by Leopold von Ranke in the 19th century, or Arnold Toynbee and William H. McNeill in the 20th. But a global history that links the different parts of the world, rather than telling their discrete stories, has emerged only recently, as historians have begun to examine subjects such as the effects of empire on European economies, societies, cultures, and political systems, notably, but not exclusively, those of Britain. The global economic ties that bound Europe to other parts of the world in a nexus of mutual interaction, and the rise of worldwide empire as a common European process, rather than one specific to any particular European nation. Historians have also been busy rewriting the history of individual European nations in a global context, emphasizing the effects of European diasporas, the millions of Europeans who emigrated to other parts of the globe